condemned the disgusting act under the guise of freedom of speech. The Afghan politicians unanimously announced that the spirit and essence of coexistence of ideas and thoughts is definitely on the line, then on.
During the protest, people of Afghanistan have called for the unity among believers of all Ibrahimic religions towards such targeted attacks, which have mainly aimed at weakening believing souls and freedom seekers of the entire world, and not just Islam and Muslims. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Thousands of people have taken part in the funeral procession of Palestinians killed in the Israeli forces raid on the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday. Carrying the martyrs' bodies, the mourners chanted slogans condemning the Israeli crimes. It was early Thursday when Palestinian media reported the regime forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp. The savage attack left the residents and popular resistance groups based in the camp with no choice but to defend themselves and confront the regime forces.
What happened today in Jenin Governorate is a massacre in the very sense of the word. We received 8 martyrs and 1 martyr in Ibn Sina Hospital. In addition to 18 wounded, 3 of them are in a very serious condition. Most of the injuries were due to direct targeting with the aim of killing.
Later in the day, the Israeli troops fatally shot another Palestinian in the town of Al-Ram, near the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Palestinian was killed during a protest against the Israeli forces' raid on Jenin. With a total death toll of 10, January 26th turned into one of the deadliest days in the occupied West Bank since Israel's military raids intensified at the start of last year. Iran's foreign ministry reacted to the bloody incident. It called on Muslim countries to unite and coordinate their actions in support of the oppressed Palestinian nation and the resistance to stop the apartheid regime's acts of terror. Palestinian resistance groups have also condemned the Israeli atrocity in the strongest words, calling for continued resistance against the regime.
The massacre that the Israeli occupation army committed in Jenin confirms the racist, fascist, and criminal nature of the right-wing occupation government. This aggression, in addition to the continued violations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and of the rights of the Palestinians in Israel, shows that this government insists on escalating the situation.
Our resistance will carry on and shall not back off from confronting this Zionist occupier, and the killing will not intimidate us and will not be intimidated by these threats made by the criminal leaders of this Zionist entity.
Palestinian resistance movements say the latest Israeli raid on Jenin comes within the context of recent escalations, especially in light of the new far-right cabinet headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist allies. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both expressed readiness to fight back in case these raids continue. Analysts believe that Palestinians need to bolster resistance against Israel to neutralize the regime's vicious plots.
The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing.
Actually, they mean to eliminate the resistance in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, to pave the way to construct more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in which we all know that these settlements are internationally illegal.
Jenin is among those areas in the northern West Bank where Israel intensified its raids over the past year in an attempt to crack down on the Palestinian resistance. In addition to Palestinian resistance fighters, civilians confronting the Israeli army during such raids and even bystanders have been killed mercilessly. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the occupied West Bank last year. Moreover, at least 29 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed in January 2023 alone.
I'm heading with humanitarian aid workers to drop off desperately needed supplies to civilians on the outskirts of Donetsk. Recently, fighting has become fierce as Russia seeks to advance across much of Donbass. A Russian tank fires at Ukrainian positions. As we drive, the boom of incoming not far off, we see the smoke rising from amongst the trees. A few moments later, a Russian artillery unit emerges from the site of the strike. They were hit. We arrive at the arranged gathering site to drop off the supplies. These people live only hundreds of meters from the front and spend most of their time cowering in their apartments.
Now, while I have reported on dozens of the Ukrainian terror strikes in the center of Donetsk, where there are no discernible military targets, bus stations, schools, markets, here we're so close to the front line that the civilians who live here run the extreme risk of getting hit by indirect Ukrainian fire. You can hear the constant incoming and outgoing around these areas. The people here tell me that just yesterday a music school was hit, killing a local man.
Tatiana Montion is a renowned Ukrainian lawyer, today helping to deliver aid.
Where they have to live. You can imagine how many people here. It's about 100,000 people all around the front line. How is it possible to move these people somewhere in safe place? It's impossible, absolutely impossible. So we do what we do. They have no shops, they have no transport, they have no possibility to feed themselves, so we help them.
Tatiana fled Kiev to Donbass 2 years ago, fearing arrest for her outspoken criticism of the Ukrainian government.
Everybody here understands that it's United States made all this trash to weaken European economy, to crash European economy, to force European industry to move to United States. Everybody here understands it. But why not European people? Ordinary people, of course, because I am sure that European top elite understands it best of all. But they're too corrupt to tell about it to their peoples.
On our way to the next drop-off, we're stopped by Russian soldiers. They tell us not to carry on the same road. We get out of the car to assess our options. There is heavy fire nearby. That's the reality across much of Donbass. Back in the car, massive incoming close by, and we're left no choice but to drive fast. In this desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland, it's artillery doing most of the killing. At the next drop-off, this woman tells me her mother is dying on the other side of the front, so she can't be with her in her final days. She breaks down in tears, saying she wants both sides to negotiate a peace. With peace negotiations further away than ever, both Russia and NATO seem determined to end this war with brute force. For the civilians trapped along either side of the battle lines, survival is a daily chore. Many won't see the end of the war. Many won't see the end of this week. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Celebrating January 26th, best known as Australia Day, has become increasingly controversial in recent years, with people holding rallies on this day to highlight the historical plight of Aboriginals. Many Indigenous Australians who traced their lineage on the continent back 50,000 years regard it as Invasion Day. Tens of thousands of protesters lined up in Sydney, while thousands more gathered in Melbourne, Canberra, and other cities, saying the day marks the beginning of colonial oppression and genocide.
Nobody's got the right to celebrate genocide. That's it. This is ground zero, genocide. Ground zero happened here on 26th of January, 1788. Nobody should be celebrating. It's not an event to celebrate.
The government has designated January 26th as National Day, which marks the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of the first fleet of British ships in Port Jackson. But protesters believe the government is still trying to gloss over the scale of British colonizers' crimes against Native Australians.
I think most white Australians would not celebrate this day at all if they knew exactly that level of depression and deep sadness.
There are several accounts of how colonizers wiped out Indigenous communities in Australia through brutal and heart-wrenching repression. Emily Caroline Cray, a young settler traveling through northwest Queensland in 1883, recounts some of the British colonizers' horrendous crimes in her personal diary.
The station owner has 40 pairs of black's ears nailed around the walls collected during raiding parties after the loss of many cattle speared by the blacks.
Aboriginal people remain the most disadvantaged Australians, with higher rates of poverty, health issues and imprisonment than any other community. Now more than 2.5 centuries later, they're still struggling to find their feet in a white-dominated society. Australia's Prime Minister is planning to hold a referendum in March on recognizing around 4% Indigenous people in the Constitution. But repeated calls to abolish the controversial National Day have fell on deaf ear, as the government remains adamant to celebrate what many call the anniversary of Australia's colonization.
Due to a surge in respiratory infections, hospital emergency departments in many EU countries are currently being overwhelmed. Hundreds of drugs to treat winter-related illnesses are unavailable in most of the bloc's 27 nations. The crisis has been raised in the European Parliament.
We debate again about shortage of different medicines, most notably antibiotics. This debate is the proof that the European Commission is not the solution, but the cause of many problems all across Europe.
EU inflation is very high because of energy sanctions against Russia. The production of drugs in the bloc has slumped because of rising manufacturing costs associated with inflation. China is a major supplier, but relations between Brussels and Beijing have deteriorated.
We are witnessing public health systems across the EU become overwhelmed and exhausted as a result of the recent surge of COVID-19, flu, and RSV patients.
Critics say as a result of following US foreign policy, EU leaders have created a new health crisis by jeopardizing global supply chains. A growing number of EU health workers are forced to stay at home after becoming ill themselves.
The workers in the field are not getting to work. They are perhaps at work and not being productive sufficiently or not contributing well. And that affects the economy at the same time.
Experts say standards in health services across the EU vary greatly. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%. There are warnings the current health emergency could get even worse.
The COVID virus is still circulating within Europe, and I wanted to share with you that we're closely monitoring the situation in China and, of course, in the United States, where a new Omicron subvariant has appeared.
It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical equipment to Italy when COVID-19 first struck Europe. It's the type of cooperation we are unlikely to see again anytime soon. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For more than 120 years, the steelworks have dotted the Scunthorpe skyline. Its glory days when tens of thousands of people worked here are long gone. And these are anxious times for the 4,000 or so staff on shift and tens of thousands in the supply chain. British Steel is the UK's second largest steel manufacturer after India-owned Tata Group, ranking 25th worldwide and 8th in Europe. However, it's been troubled for decades. In 2019, the uncertainty over Brexit pushed it to bankruptcy. Since then, it's had three owners, most recently China's Jingye Group, which is asking the British government for hundreds of millions of dollars to go green and to keep its doors open.
A long tale to it, this story of the decline of the British steel industry. And you can take it all the way back to after the Second World War, where there was a lack of real investment going in, and the result being not being very competitive, and other emerging nations, our very successful nations, like, for example, Korea and obviously China, now producing steel at a cheaper price, more efficiently, and the UK was left behind.
Soaring energy prices fueled by the UK-backed war in Ukraine, carbon taxes and lost markets are only some of the reasons that have added to the already tough trading conditions. The $370 million rescue package from the government is to help British Steel replace its energy-intensive coal-burning blast furnaces with electric alternatives. Only a short while after Number 10 gave the green light for a new coal mine near Scotland.
Sadly, we're going to be seeing over the next few years more contradictory issues when it comes to what's green, what's environmentally acceptable and what is not. And then put that against actually the practical issues about the difficulties in obtaining power, the cost of power, and a lot of that you could say put down to the war in Ukraine. But it's a global issue, this one, which is going to mean that politicians will be, I'm afraid, well, whether it's actually greenwash or pure green is going to be interesting to see actually what comes out.
It also comes a few days after British Volt, a car battery gigafactory, touted as a Brexit success story, declared bankruptcy.
British Steel underpins essential sectors in the UK economy, from aerospace to transport to construction. And the unions, such as GMB, are saying that the government handout will do little for the long-term future of an industry that's lurching from one crisis to another. Saipur is up, Scunthorpe.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional 500 million euro military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic, and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The death of seven Israelis at a synagogue at the hands of a Palestinian, and in less than 24 hours, another shooting incident resulting in the injury of two Israelis. These incidents may have come as a shock to many, but it falls pale to the number of Palestinians that have been killed at the hands of the Israeli regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's security failure, the rise of grassroots Palestinians against the Israeli regime, and whether this new cabinet can even last what appears to be a wave of Palestinian resistance, including Israel's internal crisis with its own people. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Frank Hughes, author and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to you both. Farah Hughes, first to you. So you have seven Israelis that were killed. 21 years old is the age of the person, or the Palestinian who did that. And then in less than 24 hours, you have another two that were injured in a shooting incident. This one was carried out by a 13-year-old. I'm mentioning the age because it's significant in the follow-up questions that I'm going to ask. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
Well, I think if we put things in context, as you've seen last year in 2022, 150 Palestinians were killed, murdered, summarily executed by the Israeli illegal occupation in the West Bank. And already in January and the first month of 2023, we have had up to 40 Palestinians summarily executed, along with many, many more injured. I think if you look back at the history of the occupation, which is illegal, if you look at the 1 million illegal Zionist Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank. This is in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that Israel, as an occupying force, illegally occupying force, should not move its civilian population into the occupied territories. Indeed, in 2002 in Jenin, you had this refugee camp filled with refugees from 1948. When Israel, the Israeli state, was born in bloodshed by terrorism, by many of the people who went on to become the leaders of Israel at that time were branded by the British government as terrorists. In 2002, you had 52 people murdered in Jenin by the illegal Zionist occupation forces. So there is a history going back to 1948 and the Nakba. There's a history going back to 1967 and the illegal occupation of the West Bank, of the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and from their homes. While Israeli settlers build homes illegally on land that has been confiscated or stolen or illegally occupied by the settler movement, they have stolen water resources, they have stolen arable land, and they have occupied the homes of the indigenous population. So when we see heavily armed troops going into Jenin, a refugee camp, in order to summarily arrest and or execute people, you know, you're going to have resistance to this oppression. And Palestinians, under international law, can use any and all means of resistance against this illegal occupation. And with the new right-wing Israeli government heavily kind of indebted to the settler movement, right, and getting a lot of their votes and a lot of their political value from the settler movement, I'm not surprised that settlers have faced the brunt of Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, if you want to take a look at this, Arnold August, what our guest there said, obviously there's a history there of the way that Palestinians have been violated in so many words. I mean, from the deaths to the detainment to all the core issues that exist. I mean, we can go through. We can't because we don't have the time. But so many ways that they have been violated. So many are not shocked at what has happened. And that is one of the most interesting points, because even Israelis, in terms of the outpouring, if you want to gauge even social media, even though they regret what has happened, but they're not really that shocked as they should be, because Israel has violated Palestinian rights so much, especially with the most recent massacre that occurred in Jenin refugee camp. So wasn't this a natural occurrence, as the Palestinian resistance groups have said, to occur, and this being based on what happened in Jenin with that massacre of the 10 Palestinians?
Yeah, thank you for having me, and both what you said and what Fred just mentioned as well, I think we're pointing to a very important scenario or analysis, and that is the resistance in Palestine is developing, has been developing for some time. And I guess this is one of the reasons that Israel tries to intimidate the Palestinian resistance, for example, what they did in Jenin. And I would like to say we're not alone in thinking that. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Global Gathering in support of the Palestinian resistance, and they just issue a very powerful statement only a few hours ago in which they say that this, they fully support the attack against the Israelis in Jerusalem, and is part of this wave of further development of Palestinian resistance using armed struggle. It is their only way. How else can Palestinians defend themselves if it is not for armed struggle? And I think that we are heading in that direction. And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the reaction from the ground in Israel is not as powerful against this act by the Palestinians as it normally is. But I think it's one thing is clear, that Jerusalem is occupied by United States and Israel. And according to all laws and norms internationally, an occupied people have a right to resist. And this is what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. They had a right to resist. Of course, this is being, well, the United States, of course, their spokesman, Blinken, and others from the State Department, they didn't blink an eye. Sorry for the pun. They didn't blink an eye. They called it a terrorist organization, while at the same time saying, well, we don't have all the facts, what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. We know the facts. The main fact is that Israel, as an arm of the United States, has been carrying on this terrorist activity, as Fra just mentioned, for many years. We're talking about decades, and it is bound to erupt as it has in Jerusalem today, and who knows what will happen again. In fact, there was another attack only a few hours ago, so this is building up, and the armed resistance is building up. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is very important for the morale and also armaments for the Palestinian resistance. This has to come to an end. We are in a stage where no one can turn a blind eye to the massacres, or I would say genocide, ongoing genocide by the Israeli Zionist entity against the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, I just checked before I asked I was going to ask you this question, Fra Hughes, as to whether there was an outcome from the cabinet meeting that Netanyahu has held. So far, there's no news on that. And the reason why I'm bringing this topic up is because based on the source of an Israeli journalist and commentator who worked for Israel's Channel 13 News, he has said that the recommendations by Prime Minister Netanyahu will be for a law to deport families of terrorists, in reference to the Palestinians, immediate sealing of terrorist homes, arresting family members and friends, and then sending out reinforcements to the occupied West Bank. And then the last one, which we're going to get into later, approving more gun licenses to the civilian population of Israel. Now, that's really important, and I don't want to have you address this now, because I'm going to ask the question later. But it does not sound appropriate to the degree of violence that you would expect from this cabinet. It almost sounds like they're somewhat intimidated. The tone of what's being proposed is not that extreme, if I may use that word, unless that's an incorrect interpretation of what's being proposed. Because one would think you would think things like, let's go to the Palestinian homes and get rid of Palestinians, etc. But it doesn't have that type of a tone to it. Am I reading this correctly, first of all?
I'm not sure. I think it's a very extreme reaction. I know over the years it has been Israeli policy, or has been in the past, to knock down the homes of the people who are involved in resistance and in resistance operations, and indeed to knock down maybe the homes either side or parallel to the home of the Palestinian resistance fighter. I mean, this is actually, a punitive revenge and retribution upon the community. This is collective punishment against individual acts. I heard the father of the martyr yesterday, who was involved in the operation in Al-Quds, say that he was unaware that his son was perhaps a member of any paramilitary resistance organization. He stated that, you know, everyone has a different view on the occupation and how to resist that, or how to kind of rebel against what the occupation is doing. So, you know, these community kind of repercussions where you knock down the home of the family. Indeed, it's the first time I've heard of Israel threatening to deport the families. I mean, are they going to deport them to Jordan? Are they going to deport them to Gaza, which is more likely? This is a form of continued ethnic cleansing, a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, if you have an intifada, for example, in the West Bank, and you have tens of thousands of young men, teenage boys, engaged in throwing bricks and bottles at armored vehicles that can do absolutely no damage to them. When you look at the nine people who were martyred in Jenin, you know, the Israeli army was claiming that there was a gun battle, but no Israeli troops have been injured. So, I mean, where are the guns? Where are the weapons? Where is the video camera surveillance? Because drones were involved and missiles were involved. And I read that their initial raid, that they came in a refrigerated van, in a civilian van, surrounded a house and fired missiles at it. So this is the response of the Israeli offensive forces, is to surround, attack. And apparently there were four people found dead in that building once the Israeli forces withdrew.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think, Arnold August, about these recommendations that supposedly is going to be brought up in this cabinet meeting? Again, this is not confirmed yet, but I guess they're, and rightly so, says that these are pretty severe and extreme, because some of the comments that I'm reading now on social media are actually pointing towards that, saying they're ethnic cleansing, just like our guest Fra Hughes there said. Because, for example, law for deporting families of terrorists, again, as Israel sees them, or immediate sealing of terrorist homes, or arresting family members and friends, these are all pretty severe, based on the viewpoint. Do you agree with that, that the steps taken are severe? Because it also points to the extinguishing the Palestinian existence off the land, in a sense.
Yes, it is a very serious set of actions that the Israeli government is considering. But I think if they do that, it will backfire, because the Israelis know, whether they admit it or not, but the resistance, the armed resistance, for example, supported to a large extent by Iran, and the resistance on the ground has been building up for several months now. And I like to, you know, the United States and Israel may be in for a surprise. I like to quote from the my board, in which I'm a member, and they say openly that the person who carried that out in Jerusalem, Kari Al-Kam, is a young Magdisi resistance fighter who was breastfeeded with a Palestinian mother's milk. So here we go. While Israel is perhaps going to take some extreme action, the resistance, in my view, has never been stronger than it is now.
and also the use of social media by the resistance. We often talk the social media used by United States or Israel, but the social media increasingly being used by the resistance is going to provide a further emphasis, a further impulse to the type of resistance that we're seeing, where the gathering, the group of gathering in Lebanon say openly, we have to use rifles, we have to use arms in order to overthrow the Zionist regime and head towards the liberation of Palestine. Uh-huh. So United States, they must be blustering, but there's the other side of the story as well. Increased development, the increased level of struggle based on any means necessary.
Well, this new phase, some have called it, Frahius, whether you agree or not, is my question to you, where you have these sole individuals, Palestinians, that is, who are emerging and acting on their own, even though they're carrying out pretty sophisticated operation, like what has happened in the past two incidents in the past 24 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have them so young. I mean, we're looking at 21-year-old and a 13-year-old that have carried it out. But it's somewhat smelling a new resistance, isn't it, in terms of the operation being carried out by them, because they have no affiliations with typical resistance groups like Islamic Jihad or Hamas. And one example, good example, I guess, would be a group by the name of Den of Lions that was that emerged in August of 2022, where they acted against the Israeli regime. Are we looking at this being a more commonplace incidents of these Palestinians with no affiliations rising up on their own? And of course, it's because they're being choked by the Israeli regime in terms of a variety of things that you're well aware of.
Well, I think one of the major dangers that you've just alluded to for the Israeli state and for the settler movement is that I'm sure there are many brave members of the resistance groups, but I'm sure there are many people who are the eyes and ears of the Israeli security forces, Shin Bet, etc., Mossad within the West Bank, who do watch the resistance groups, do watch the resistance fighters, do watch the commanders, and do inform on the resistance groups within the West Bank. So if you're going to have individuals and young people with absolutely no affiliations and be seen to be clean operatives, it'll be very difficult to stop these attacks going forward. And there's maybe two things I'd like to say. One of them is, I think it was Golda Meir who said that the old will die and the young will forget. Well, a 21-year-old Palestinian in Al-Quds did not forget, and a 13-year-old boy who apparently his brother has already been martyred by the Israeli illegal occupation. So if you're going to kill 16-year-old boys, you may well find their 13-year-old siblings coming forward demanding a pound of flesh. And it reminds me in many respects of the suicide bombings that happened in and around, I would guess, 2002 with what happened in Jenin. If you keep crushing a people, if you keep destroying their homes, stealing their futures, giving them nightmares instead of dreams of a peaceful future, people have nothing else to react with except their own lives. And if they're willing to submit their lives, to make a point and to fight the oppressive illegal regime that oppresses them and represses them, I think that's something that you'll see more of.
Well, taking a look at Israel right now as we speak, in terms of its occupying Palestine, the land of Palestine, there are protests that are happening, Arnold, August, and I mentioned that in the beginning in my question. You have Israelis that are out there protesting. Now, take a guess as to what they are protesting. Your options would be A, are they protesting how they're against this cabinet, taking laws in their own hand, wanting to reform what they call judiciary, which is under question in terms of it even being a judiciary, or B, it's because of what happened, which is one of the worst attacks. In the past 24 hours, you have seven Israelis that were killed, some in serious condition, with another two in a span of 24 hours. Which do you think they're protesting?
Well, I didn't see the footage of that, nor did I have a chance to read the report.
I'll tell you what they're protesting. They're protesting about those laws. To them, though there's seven Israelis that were killed in less than 24 hours, that to them is not even a concern, because for them, their concern is how Netanyahu Arnold August, are you with us? Okay, good. Their concern is how Netanyahu is trying to take laws into its own hands to try to decrease or trying to favor laws to its own favor, trying to reform laws to his own favor. Now, my question is, you have that on the one hand. You have Palestinians, young Palestinians with no affiliations rising up. You have the resistance groups at the same time. These are pulling this new cabinet apart in different directions. What are the chances of it surviving this?
I think, thank you for quoting that. It makes it very clear. So the people in Israel, occupied Palestine, who are demonstrating against the government, even though it may not be very clear, but if they're against the right-wing, very drastic attempts by the Netanyahu government against Palestine, it's very good that they are opposing it and in the streets to demonstrate against this genocidal policy. I'd like to make one comment. You mentioned some people who've been carrying it out these last actions in the last 2 days are not affiliated apparently with any other group. Well, I see this as a positive thing because the organization of the armed resistance is no longer completely controlled, even though it is a good thing, by the formal resistance, that people are taking things in their own hands. Like 30 young people were killed in Palestine by Israel just in the month of January, and the month is not yet finished. So put yourself in a position of a young Palestinian. They have to fight back, and the only way is by armed resistance.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Arnold August there, author and journalist from Montreal. Thank you. And Fry Hughes, author and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In 1960s, Burkina Faso became a self-governing nation within the French colony. Today, it has announced the decision to end diplomatic relations between France and Burkina Faso. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Burkina Faso has demanded the withdrawal of French troops stationed on the territory of the West African nation. Local media reported recently, citing a government decision. Relations between Paris and its former colony have been on a downward spiral for months now, with the local population blaming France for their security problems. Agence d'information du Burkina AIB reported that the government of Burkina Faso had suspended 2018 agreement with France, which regulated the deployment of its service members in the country. Paris now has 1 month to remove its troops, the agency said. France currently has 400 troops in the African country who are stationed there as part of efforts to combat terrorist groups in the region. Recently, hundreds of people protested in the capital city of Burkina Faso against the foreign military presence, chanting anti-French slogans. This and similar demonstrations have been fueled by a popular perception that French troops are unable to protect civilians from the terrorist groups who are active in the northern part of the country. The protests took place in the wake of the expulsion of the French ambassador to the country, which has undergone two coups since January 2022. In November, French President Emmanuel Macron officially announced the end of anti-insurgent Operation Barkhane in the Sahel region, which has been largely viewed as a failure. In doing so, France also vowed to reduce the exposure and visibility of its military forces in Africa. The Sahel is a region in northern Africa that includes Senegal, Mauritania, Mali, Burkina Faso, and a number of other neighboring countries. Paris ended another military mission in neighboring Mali last August after relations went sour, with the government calling France's military involvement not satisfactory. According to the website of Asiana Times, the French military has been stationed in Burkina Faso for fighting against terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIL. The AIB said the military government suspended 2018 military accord that allowed the presence of French troops in the country. No comments from France have come yet. Despite their presence on Burkinabel soil with huge equipment and their power at the intelligence level, they couldn't help us defeat terrorism. It therefore was time for us to get rid of them. And that's what the transition government is doing with a lot of boldness, said Passamade Suadogo, a prominent civil society activist, while talking to the Associated Press news agency. Ibrahim Traoré has been sworn in as interim president of Burkina Faso several weeks after Paul Henri Sandaogo was removed in a coup. Our aims are none other than the reconquest of territory occupied by these hordes of terrorists, he added after taking oath in October last year. Burkina's existence is in danger, he said. Widespread protests were seen in Africa's poorest nation-state, rallying in the capital, demanding the expulsion of the French envoy and the closure of its military base in Burkina Faso. Mohamed Sinon, one of the organizers of the demonstration, said, "We are a Pan-African movement and we want cooperation between Burkina Faso and Russia, but also the strengthening of friendship and of cooperation with Guinea and Mali." The rally is a way to support the present and the national security forces in fighting terrorist affiliate groups. Similar coups based on independence from France have occurred in the last decade in Africa, which has become a source of inspiration for Burkina Faso. Mali, Niger, and Chad are some examples. In Mali, the last of 2,400 French troops stationed there left in August after 9 years of so-called fighting with terrorist groups.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.